Okay, yeah. The book, perhaps I should just connect the book to the exhibition. The book came first, and this occurred quite strangely, really. I'd had another book published, Welcome University Press. Marty Friedman had died at the end of 2016, and I'd written a book about her work generally, and career generally, which was published in 2009. And then I had this other book published in 2017, Strangers Arrive, Immigration and Visual Arts in New Zealand. And after this was published, the director of the Auckland University Press said, well, what's next? So I thought, well, what's next? So I thought quickly, and this sort of came to mind, a book which focused on Marty Friedlander's portraits of artists and writers and potters and people involved with dance and music, generally. And so that was taken on. And then, almost coincidentally, the book was published in 2020, about September. Late 2019, Janine Parkinson, who is still director, newish director of the Portrait Gallery in Wellington, asked me, well, have you got any ideas for an exhibition? And it was perfect. So I put an exhibition, chose, there were about 80 or so photographs in that exhibition, was the New Zealand Portrait Gallery. Tale was really the curator involved there. And it attracted a lot of people, as I recall. And then it toured to Waikato Art Museum, Stratford North, Tauru in Auckland and Titirangi, Suta in Nelson, and then smaller versions or iterations at the Northern Club in Auckland, which seems rather a curious venue, but they were keen to have it. And then Tale got onto it, and what we have here is, how to put it, much reduced in terms of the numbers of photo portraits by Marty Friedlander. And what I thought was a wonderful idea, to pair, as you see, a photograph of a particular artist with a work by that artist. And because I only first saw this show this morning, and what struck me is, you know, why hadn't anyone thought of it before? To me, you know, it works brilliantly. And Marty, before she took up photography in London, she initially went to the Camberwell School of Arts and realised pretty quickly she wasn't going to be much of an artist. And quite by chance, then she was accepted into a photography course because they had a spare place. She otherwise was going to be going to the sort of, I think it was kind of sewing and knitting or whatever. It wasn't fashion. Well, anyway, so she became photographer, worked, and then worked with a couple of very good photographers in London as their studio assistant, which more than that involved doing a lot of the printing. So she had a long apprenticeship in terms of developing negatives and touching up work. The two photographers, one was largely a fashion photographer, a man called Gordon Crocker, who was very much a kind of in loco parentis, as an orphan, sort of a father figure in a way. And the other one was a fellow called Douglas Glass, who was a New Zealand born person who never returned to New Zealand after having left Britain, saying he hated New Zealand. And for reasons that made sense, he had a very oppressive and repressive childhood and growing up. So he went to Britain. Initially, he was a painter, and he was probably the first abstract painter of New Zealand birth in Britain. But then he became a photographer, and for many years, he was the photographer, the portrait photographer for the Sunday Star Times in London, over about 15 years. And a brilliant portraitist. I'll just Google his name. So Marty did have, you know, very close and immersive training, if you like, both in materials and techniques and in the business of making photographs, portrait photographs. Coming to New Zealand, initially simply because her husband, Berlin born, but came to New Zealand as a child, was returning to New Zealand. Initially she was a bit of a loss. But she quickly, because she'd been very much involved with the arts generally in London in the 40s and 50s, she quickly noticed in what was then a fairly small art world that artists and writers and creative people generally really didn't get the sort of recognition that you would expect in a larger country. Of course, New Zealand's like a couple of million, 2.5 million at that point. So from early on, this was quite a conscious and deliberate project to take as many photographs of artists and writers and potters and musicians and so on as she could. And so over a very long period, the first one that was published was in 1959 of Morris G, the novelist, which is in the book. And serendipity seemed to play a large role in her life. She was living in Henderson, which was more of a small town on the fringes of Auckland then, where her husband was working as a dentist, Gerard Stillbrown, at 92 or so. They made a pretty idiosyncratic couple. And by chance, next door lived Morris G's parents, Lyndall and, I've forgotten his father's name, who was a builder. And Morris just happened to come by one day on his way to Australia. Things were going rather badly. Marriage was collapsing, and he really wasn't known as a writer. He was just beginning as a writer. So she took a series of photographs of him. He was a little bit reluctant at first. I don't know whether you've looked at the book, but the photographs, and I mean, there it was, 1959. You could see that she was born for this almost, allowing for a training. I don't know, say I know Morris, but I've met him a number of times, talked to him, quite a reserved and shy man. On the other hand, quite a sort of composed and assured person. And those photographs of Morris G, as was so often the case with her best photographs, and I say best photographs because she was very critical of her own work. In fact, would be very dismissive and say, well, that's just not good enough. That can never be published or reproduced or etc., etc. She, with that photograph of Morris, and I think I note that in the sort of introductory wall text there, that ability which you find, of course, in painters and the best portrait photographers, there's an uncanny element here, somehow bringing out or visualizing what are conflicting or contradictory qualities within a person. I mean, most portrait photography is, well, standard commercial portrait photography was pretty straight up and down. People wanted photographs in which they looked good, so they were often flattering and carefully posed and so on, in a studio. So Marty was among really the first, I don't think she would have liked the term. She liked the photographer. She didn't like being called an artist, but she really was an artist slash photographer. And who moved away, this is within New Zealand, from pretty formulaic, standard, often stereotypical portrait modes. And all the photographs here, I think all of them, except one, I suspect, we'll see from here, Ted Kinley's Sides in the Far Corner, which is from an exhibition. I saw the exhibition back in 1969 at the New Vision Gallery in Auckland. And I'm sure that was taken at the New Vision Gallery. All the other ones are taken in domestic situations, either the houses or studios or nearby where the artist happened to be living or staying. As with the one you'll see in a moment of Robin White around the corner from 1969. Robin was probably just completed art school, I suspect. That's at the house of Claudia Pond Eilig, who is a close friend, still is, who lived in, still does, lived in Mount Eden. So it's before, should we just pop her out? Yeah. Before I, typical colonial period house in Auckland, Mount Eden, old suburb, one of the old suburbs. And, of course, what Tale has ingeniously done is pair it with this graphic work by Robin White below of some of, how do you put it, more recent house, like an interwar house, Kaitangata, that's south of Dunedin, where she was living in the late 1970s. Okay, so here we have it, Robin, Some, have any of you met Robin White? Or you probably did, Charlie, at the time, yeah. Again, I mean, she's a very composed person. Sometimes she seems shy, but very assured, and has been very influential. I think it's kind of, you know, extraordinary career in terms of her own work and also as a teacher and mentor and guide. And there she is, if she's about my age, so there she is about 24 or so, the start of what was going to be a very successful career, looking directly back at us. Unless I'm projecting, I feel those qualities I've just attributed to her visualized in the photograph too. And Marty did have the ability with her best photographs, and there are many of them, and I think this is particularly evident in her photographs of artists and writers, of going beyond the surface. I mean, that sounds a bit paradoxical. On one hand, of course, photographs, portrait photographs of this kind, are representations, visualizations of what is there to be seen. Yet at the same time, one has a sense of interiority, sort of inner qualities of a person, which mightn't necessarily be immediately evident. You mightn't even be conscious of them, and just having a conversation or sitting around with the person, or as we are now. And I guess that's what these best portraits allow us, to spend time with faces, endlessly intriguing faces of creative and complex people. I know about half the people who are photographed here. I think, in what I know of the others, they're all very complex individuals, thinking their own thoughts, not prone to groupthink or doing what they're told and so on to various degrees. The extreme of not doing what they were told are the two over here, Tony Fomerson and Philip Claremont.
Yeah.
And again, that's taken in the late 70s. Actually, at Tony Fomerson's house, which was in Ponsonby Freeman's Bay area of Auckland, which was pretty run down much in that period. I knew Tony, but he was one of those people I sort of sensed are probably a little bit risky you get too close to. So we always got on fine when we saw one another, but unfortunately he was prone to falling out with people, coming too close. So fascinating and intriguing fellow whose paintings sort of look better by the year. I mean, it's, and again, these paradoxical states where, and this is the same with quite a few of the artists here. Again, I say 50 years on or 40 years on, their paintings look better. You somehow get more from them than one did when they're initially exhibited. I mean, that's, I suppose, an accumulation of associations, experiences, and so on. But anyway, the two here, leading wildly bohemian lives, self-destructive, unfortunately, very different in terms of their personalities. Philip Claremont, a lovely fellow. Everyone liked him. Kind of unsensed his vulnerability, and he tragically took his own life in the early 1980s. Tony, they were very close friends, and best of my knowledge, they remained close friends. Tony was, I think I might have written this in the text of the book, or how did a person like Tony come out of the Christchurch suburbs in the 1950s? I mean, it's one of those mysteries, but of course, on the other hand, it's not, because typically, and I don't want to sort of be reductive here, but a lot of these artists here had a sense, again, of, you know, being artists, having to be artists, driven to be creative, knowing that it sort of went against mainstream currents in society. I mean, now many more people are much more open and appreciative and accepting of the arts. So there is a much bigger art world. Most of the people here and in the book journey grew up in a very much more limited, circumscribed world in various ways. So that tension between the world of art and mainstream society was very strong in the 60s and 70s. I mean, growing up in that period, I can recall it well. In the wall text there, that I think I've stated that they're more than just portraits of individuals. Both individually and collectively, it's a portrait of a sort of social climate, social worlds too. And Tal and I were looking at this morning too, and what immediately struck me, it's more than just the artist's world or a particular sort of boho social media in Auckland. It was a pretty genuinely chaotic world. I mean, kind of collective madness around at times. If you think of the government of the day with all too. Anyway, I won't get onto that. And that's what somehow struck me coming in, not having looked at it for a long time. Oh my God, that's a sort of kind of brilliant visualization of a broader social climate. Tense, highly conflictive, I think much more so than New Zealand society now, you know, even considering the eruptions that have been occurring over the last few years. And one other thing, this is bizarre, which you don't see often. I have never really noticed the small dog on the... I mean, again, it's kind of perfect in a way, that small dog who's... I didn't even know either of them had a dog, but obviously they must have... There it is. Those are paintings by Alan Maddox, and behind, again, another rather tragic figure, self-destructive. I think very much expressed in sort of deleting-like crosses, crossings out and deletions of one kind. And another, yes, there's probably various substances lying around there.
Which one is which?
Oh, this is Tony Thomas and here. And Philip. So in the book there are several photographs of each of them. And again, quite a number of these people, Marty took photographs over a period, on several occasions, as with Gordon Walters, who couldn't think of a different sort of person from these two than Gordon Walters. And interestingly enough, Tony Thomason was a great admirer of Gordon Walters' work. Gordon at this stage was living in Christchurch, from where Tony came. I've come across letters from Tony to Gordon. They got on well. Gordon was a quiet, modest, kind of self-effacing sort of man, sort of the opposite of Tony Thomason. So they sort of respected what one another was doing. And there, the pairing, the bringing of the work and the artist together, I mean, that... You can see what Marty was doing, and this is so with, as Tal observed this morning, with quite a number of these photographs, how her visualizing of the artist, her presentation of the artist, has within it, if you like, traces of the artist's practice and work, in terms compositionally, in terms of look, manner, and so on. Just, of course, there is a more minimal geometric abstract works by Gordon on the wall behind. But it's as if her composition is modelled on those sort of beautifully asymmetric equilibria of Gordon Walters' work, like the one on the left, where I think anything can't be out of place. And what struck me about the painting this morning, which I haven't seen before, the two circles. They have to be there. You remove those two circles, and the painting had fallen apart. I should add at this point, this is probably a sales pitch. AUP, Auckland University Press, is publishing a monograph of Gordon Walters by Francis Pound, who died about end of 2017. He'd been working with that for many years, and Francis and I are close friends, and when he was in hospital towards the end of his life, he asked me if I'd sort of try to get it out into the world, which we've managed to do. It was probably the most difficult task to carry out, I think. Looks fantastic, I might add, but it's a kind of sales pitch. Anyway, let's just move. Do ask questions. So I'm effectively talking to the photographs. I've said a little bit about Robin White here. Graham Sidney. But again, what strikes me so much sort of going around from person to person is how strikingly different an individual these various artists are or were. Graham Sidney out there in central Otago. Where on earth did what looked like a wrecked tram car, Italian out there? Marty could be extremely witty, and it's often quite a sort of understated wit. And I knew this photograph a couple of weeks or so ago. I'm her literary artistic executive, so people, if they want to have a photograph published, have to approach me. And a book was going to be published, and they wanted to include a photograph that Marty took in the 70s of a barbecue of MPs of the day. And in the centre, there's Muldoon. Oh. And on either side of them, there are two Labour MPs. One of them is Terracotini Sullivan. First name's gone off my mind. Terracotini Sullivan. Yeah. Anyway, it's gone. And on the other side is, I think, it's either Roger Douglas's father, who was a socialist, as distinct from his son, Roger. I knew the family, grew up
in.
That's right, yeah. So there are two favourite pairs on either side, and they're each brandishing what look like machetes. Again, see, it was so funny. Sort of, the next step would be, you know, off of his head. But very understated, you know, just kind of sly wit. And I wonder whether that was at work here. But this is wonderful, this pair. I've never seen this painting, unless it was in that big retrospective music. I mean, that's quite a chilling kind of painting, in a way. Again, people speak of New Zealand Gothic and Southern Gothic. Are there intimations, again, without labouring it, sort of understated, like an undertone in the photograph there? And in the book, again, a number of photographs of Graham Sidney. There's one of Graham Sidney and his then wife, his wife, sitting on a bed in their, so Marty had inveigled her way into their bedroom. And Marty was not shy. She at times could be brazen to the point of some people, particularly more inhibited New Zealanders, you know, wondered what on earth was going on. She was fantastic company. Yes, I say, very funny, sometimes infuriating, but one of those people who is, you could, you know, even when you're arguing with her, you still liked her. On one occasion, one of my daughters had to virtually separate us from not fighting over. She was anti-cat, and I was I'm a cat person. And there we were in my own house, and she was going on about how awful cats were. The bed one, it's sitting on the bed, and looking back at us, like sort of a slightly apprehensive, it's this kind of enigmatic image. And then I found a passage from Graham Sidney himself, which I juxtaposed with a photograph in the book, in which he described as a sort of fundamental quality that he sort of aimed for in his paintings, without necessarily achieving it, a quality of mystery. Mm. So painting an image, compelling. What's going on? Mm. Mysterious, enigmatic. You know, it sort of implies a narrative, but you can't determine precisely what is being said, if anything precisely being said. So elements of ambiguity and, you know, which draw you into it, of course. I mean, those qualities in paintings, ambiguity, tend to draw you in, and likewise with photographs. And with quite a number of Marty's portraits of artists, there is a quality of ambiguity, of ambivalence, both of the artist or writer himself or herself, and the nature of the relationship between Marty Friedlander and the person she was photographing. Because they're not neutral, if you like. As most studio commercial photography is necessarily neutral, well, the photographer is necessarily neutral. Marty was it's very much sort of interactive and engaged. And she was very quick on her feet, kind of literally and metaphorically. So she didn't necessarily take a lot of photographs of a person at one city, but she would move around, direction, sometimes to the point of people feeling intimidated. And a number of people said to me that, not that I'm terrified, but they felt very intimidated when she was taking photographs of them. And on occasions this can, you know, show it. And so directing in terms of positioning of faces and bodies in terms of light, she almost invariably photographed in natural light. There are some, quite clearly, which are interiors where there would have been artificial light, but that was her preferred mode, if you like, using natural light. And I guess it was a bit, so the photographs result from a kind of calculation, quick thinking, and sort of an intuition, sensing a person in, getting them into a position, taking an angle, in an endeavour to bring out those qualities which she felt or saw in the person. And this one here, for instance, Don Driver. Again, there's some great photographs of Don Driver, including this one in the book, with all of them, one of his brilliantly absurdist, again, compelling, I mean, what on earth's going on? I've always thought that just tremendous. Don Driver, looking in New Plymouth, I mean, most artists, and this occurs in the Euro-American world and the Asian world too, most artists tend to be drawn to the big cities, the big centres, whether it's Paris or London or New York and other large urban spaces. So, of course, there are artists who live in rural areas, relatively isolated situations, and there are one or two here, like Toss Wollaston on the other side. Most of his life lived in small rural communities. But in the 1960s and into the 70s, and this was commented on at the time, Auckland, which was growing rapidly, 1945, all the four major cities in Auckland were no more than 100,000 or less different in population size. By the early 60s, Auckland had, you know, sort of was, had zoomed ahead population-wise, so the other ones seemed very much smaller, and into the 70s and beyond. And I read in a book recently published on Auckland the other day, Auckland's population growth 35 times, it increased 35 times in the period from 1900 to 2000. And it's hardly a city in the world, certainly, I don't think there's another city in the Euro-American world that expanded so rapidly. But one of the aspects of that was a growth in artistic activity, artists, theatre, music, and also the drawing of artists from other parts of New Zealand towards Auckland. Thomason, Gordon Walters for a period was in Auckland in the 60s into the 70s too, before his wife got a job at Canterbury University. So Auckland, and then to a lesser extent Christchurch and Wellington, tended to have the bulk of artistic activity, particularly artists who were attuned or wanted to be contemporary and modern in their approaches to art. So Don Driver was a kind of exception to that, living in New Plymouth, and of course he worked quite a while at the Gabbett Brewster and had a studio in the basement where that might have been taken. Now, I'm not quite sure whether this arrangement of the, you know, standard, looked like a school kid's chair and the boots and this spray of foliage was kind of an impromptu construction for the occasion of the photograph. I suspect it was. I can't remember works like that, but again, there's here we have a kind of echoing in the both of them, this bringing together of, you might think, incompatible objects to create this sort of new reality, whatever it might be, which is engaging and holy. And again, with Don Driver, was again quite a modest, sort of self-effacing, but quiet sort of fellow. A lot of people don't realize, but he had actually had a stroke, and a major stroke, about 1976, but lived on for another 35 years after that, which did affect him, but didn't seem to affect his art production. So perhaps we should move. Oh, here we have Ralph Hotchery. Of course, Ralph Hotchery and Martin became very close friends from when they first met in the 1977. He was in Dunedin at that stage. He had been in Auckland in the 60s, or after returning from Britain. 60s throughout the 60s before he went to Dunedin. I think he won Francis Hodgkin's fellowship there. She hadn't photographed him then. So he was photographed, as were a number of these artists and a wider group, as part of a project. Artists, New Zealand contemporary painters, it was going to be A to M and then N to Z, two volumes published by the notorious Alistair Taylor. Only the first volume, in fact, was published, but she took photographs of all the chosen artists, and that Ralph Hotchery was one of those. So there are many photographs of Ralph Hotchery in various situations, outside, inside, close up, distance, they run the whole gamut. And looking through these photographs taken over a period from 77 right through to not so long before his death, Ralph Hotchery had asked Marty, because that none of the photographs taken after he had a severe stroke, several strokes, let's say early 2000, they should never, you know, he didn't want them ever published. Well, certainly hers hadn't been, and they never would be. Now, I think some of the photographs of Ralph post-stroke have been published, which he certainly wouldn't have liked. It's when you look at all these photographs, and this is so with a number of the people she knew well, like the poet and writer Carl Steer, who she knew over a long period, a fairly turbulent friendship. They're like narratives of relationships. In the case of Carl Stead, from the early 1960s right through to shortly before Marty died. And quite extraordinary that, you know, how much, in fact, a good photographer working with a person in this interactive way over a long period, how that can occur. I don't think it was necessarily deliberate. I don't think, you know, she just happened to take photographs of these various people over a long period. But it is if you knew the person, it's extraordinary. What is kind of revealed, if you like. Of course, what is revealed is in terms of what you know about the person, or if you know them personally, you know your experience with the person too. So they become part of a kind of network of associations about a particular person, expanding beyond the picture frame. Now, this is these are all Martin's prints here. Later in her life, she did, when she no longer had a dark room, she did have a person, Jill Tomlin, who's a very good photographer, printing some of her works for her. And in fact, I only found this after her death, this image, several prints about this size. Now, for me, in fact, this is the one that works best in its compression. Well, in relation to the big ones, of course, it looks immediately compressed. But what, for me, it visualises brilliantly, there is an attic space. An attic space is sort of, by its very nature, a private space. I was going to say, I do point my grandchildren into the attic when they're getting out of bed. Threaten to close the door. No, that's not the case.
To me, it also looks very moronic.
Yeah, the attic, well, absolutely, yeah, there are all sorts of echoes and associations. But Ralph Hotchery was a very private person, didn't like talking about his art. And here he is, alone with the person he was very friendly with, even though they didn't necessarily see them one another a lot. Alone, I mean, that in itself generates a whole host of reverberations. Some of you may have read Vincent O'Sullivan's biography, which has some books on problematic, but there's a very problematic relationship to the estate, if you like. Anyway, should we move on to, we can. Questions? Anyone wants to make observations? Tell me I'm thinking nonsense. Over the years, there were a number of students who, I think it's fantastic. would say, this is utter nonsense. It wasn't utter, in fact. Rachel Agnes, of course, and I hear that there is going to be, again, a smaller version of the Te Papa Rita Angus exhibition coming here. I saw it at Tairua Northland, about 20 paintings. Fantastic. So, in this instance, all the photographs she took, and there are a lot of, all the photographs were taken on a single day in Wellington in 1969. The Freedamers had a painting Rita Angus, which in fact it appears in the background of a couple of other portraits, which they greatly admired, and they happened to be in Wellington, and just on the off chance, Marty thought perhaps she should go and knock on the door of Rita Angus, who again was a notoriously private, when I say notoriously private person, because she could take it very badly if people turned up at her door, and she was pretty fiery and at times quite mentally disturbed person, reading her letters in the Turnbull Library. Things she could write about people. None of us will, perhaps I can't speak for you, but most people just wouldn't write what she could write about some people. Anyway, so Marty knocked on the door, and when they arrived at the house, they saw Rita Angus room lying on a couch, and anyway, they chatted, and Rita said, "I'll come back tomorrow." And so the next day was a day devoted to taking photographs of Rita Angus. As I say, an extraordinary variety of photographs of her in both outside and inside the house. Ones like this, where there's a play on dualities and indeed the very sort of notion of the double, the actual person and then a self-portrait, and how these can play off against one another. Of course, subtle play. The sense from the portrait is of Rita Angus looking at us, directly engaged with us, whereas the actual person in the glancing to one side is probably a bit weary or of a face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball contact. Now, again, they got on very well, and Rita Angus liked the photographs. She saw most of them. They've been widely published probably since the early 70s. The other thing I think is worth noting, if you haven't sort of recognised this, Marty, as a highly skilled technician printing from negatives, her croppings could be extraordinary. So the negative wasn't for her the finished photograph. There's one school of photography, particularly called documentarians, who would assert the integrity of the negative, that you must print the photograph as the image as it appears in the negative. Well, of course, the best photographers have never done that, shall we say, unless they couldn't avoid it. Marty's croppings can be quite extraordinary. So there are some negatives where the print is about a third of the negative. And so you can find, we don't have James K. Baxter here, you can find different croppings, effectively different images of the same person from the one negative. So that when you look at a range of these, it's like sort of looking at the person from different angles and perspectives. Bringing out multi-perspectival photographs of the one person. And she would have been the first person to say, well, you can never, in quote marks, capture a person in one photograph. You can visualize qualities as you've seen and experienced them, but there's no way you're going to capture a person, define a person in a photograph, or even 500 photographs. Some of you may be familiar with Alfred Stieglitz's photo portraits of George O'Keefe. Well, I think there are about 500. And he effectively said, I'm paraphrasing obviously, that there's no way he could have, how do I put it, visualized her and all her complexity with a single photograph or even a handful of photographs. And even many, many photographs, it was really just, probing, exploring that person. But again, in terms of that sort of probing, exploring, that was very much a quality of her photographs of Art and Writers, trying to sort of probe, explore, visualize aspects of the person as she experienced them, which hopefully would also sort of enhance their works or say something about the artist and their works. Illingworth, husband and wife, Michael Illingworth, again, died fairly young in his mid-50s. He lived in Auckland during the 60s and then early 70s moved out to rural areas, sort of back to the nature. Yeah. And Ty, he was a kind of, I don't think hippie is the right word, but very much part of that sort of current of, you know, back to nature, communes and so on. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, his wife Dean, they still live on the property out in the Coromandel, which has expanded into sort of various members of the family living there. But again, extraordinary photographs of Illingworth and Dean Illingworth, which are more than just pictures of them, but pictures of a social environment, which was, again, very specific to its time. And what has always struck me about this is it's perfect. I mean, on one hand, why, if this has been placed very calculated, why put a gourd on the table with two people? But remove the gourd and that photograph would be diminished. And there was one very famous writer on photography, very famous generally as a cultural commentator. I don't think he'd call himself a muscle. Roland Barthes, French, died, he was knocked over by a car in 1980 in Paris, who wrote very brilliantly on photography. And he postulated this notion of the punctum. In other words, an element in a photograph. He's talking about the great photographs that really hold you and engage your attention. The punctum, a detail in the photograph, which pricks or punctures, that's us, the viewer, which pricks you, brings you, and it's often, indeed, like this, an anomalous detail. Perhaps like that little dog, which, in one sense, it's sort of inexplicable. But in another sense, it's crucial to the image. It is compositionally here too. Her training as a painting, her knowledge of art, painting, composition, of course, comes through strongly in all these photographs. And of course, her compositions, if you like, are arrived at in the course of printing and cropping. Some of her touchings up, not in this sort of work, in her more routine work, when she was doing, should I reveal this? I don't think she'd really mind. She was pretty outrageous on occasion when she was doing sort of commission work for papers or periodicals. Sometimes, and in those days, this was pre-digital. You'd print an image and give it to the listener or the herald or whatever, an actual, you know, hard copy print. Martin, you would sometimes touch things up with a ballpoint pen. She says, oh, this is good enough for them. So, I don't know whether that gives a sense of the person she was. Mercurial, a great friend, as I think said before, at the same time she could be infuriating. She had this ability. She talked to everyone. In her last 20 years of her life, she spent most mornings in cafes in Parnell, and whoever turned up, she'd be engaging in conversation and so on. It was extraordinary. So these come out of close and enthusiastic, sometimes abrasive, interactions with a whole variety of people. Some who she had prolonged relationships with, others didn't. There are one or two photographs where they're brilliant photographs, but you somehow sense, in the England census, they didn't really like one another. And there's some photographs of Louise Henderson, the artist, who was a pretty assertive character, pretty formidable. You wouldn't cross Louise. And I never asked, but I sensed from the photographs, not all of them, but one group of photographs, that Louise was pretty reluctant. This was for an exhibition at the New Vision Gallery. And again, there was almost, there's a sort of suspicion and mutual, not antagonism, but mutual sort of suspicion, almost bouncing off the image. And as I said, a couple of people I know have said, they found the experience of being photographed to quite quiet people, quite intimidating. Yet the photographs are just fantastic. So, yeah, a bit like a film director in that way. Some of these brilliant film directors who could make it pretty difficult for their actors.